वाहिगुरु जी का खालसा, वाहिगुरु जी की फतेह। यप,
वाहर जी का खालसा, वाहर जी की फतेह।
सो यू आर रिसीविंग मी लाउड एंड क्लियर।
Am I loud and clear? Because at this moment, I'm not using my earphones.
No, you're loud and clear. You've never been better.
So I should use not use my earphones then, okay.
Well, as long as they aren't one of those Dr. Dre ones, I guess everything goes fine. Anyhow, the topic for today was something very spontaneous. Obviously, we were supposed to do another episode, but we decided to do this because a certain species of troll were targeting Guru Tegh Bahadur on social media. So we had a influx of questions buried underneath questions as to what the truth was about Guru Tegh Bahadur. Now, the fact is, Sikh history has been altered or rewritten to such a degree that Sikhs today have started to doubt their own gurus.
Unfortunately, that's true.
Unfortunately, that's true. Now, from a Gurbani perspective, we have Guru Tegh Bahadur, who actually reformed society as well as sets a new precedent in the war for the freedom of conscience over religious dogma. The Pujari's Guru Tegh Bahadur is some Rishi Muni meditating on some high mountain. Chandi comes to him and he creates Dusht Daman to help Chandi. So that's the Pujari's Guru Tegh Bahadur. Now, which Guru Tegh Bahadur is the real Tegh Bahadur? The one we see in the picture in the Greco-Roman settings with his eyes half closed, wearing obviously a modern kurta pajama and a shawl with his eyes, very red as well from what we can see? Or the Guru Tegh Bahadur who would have actually worn a very fine imperial turban, a kalgi, a sword, ridden a horse, and been ready to lay down his life for Guru Nanak's cause? Which is the real Guru Tegh Bahadur? That's the fundamental question we will answer today.
We will answer today. Yep.
Now, I'm sure you have heard of the myth that his name was Tyagmal and that he was renamed as Tegh Bahadur.
Not just me, everybody believes that. Well, I don't believe it, but I've heard it.
Yes, and this is something we actually mentioned in one of the past episodes, but really the reality is, per Dr. Karminder Singh Tillo, is that, by no means could have Guru Hargobind named his son Tyag Mal, as Tyagta or renunciation is not a part of Sikhi.
Well, yeah, Tyag is not part of Sikhi, true.
So the first thing is, Sahibzada Tegh Bahadur first comes to our notice, historically speaking. He's born in 1621. He comes to our notice in late 1634. Now, this is the Battle of Bathinda or near Bathinda. Now, we have heard the story of how Khalil Beg, the governor of Lahore, confiscated or deliberately snatched away two war horses, Iraqi stallions intended for Guru Hargobind Sahibji from his son-in-law. So we have heard how Bidhi Chand went to Lahore and tricked him into, giving those horses to him, and he rode them away to where Guru Hargobind Sahibji was based in Ramdaspur or Amritsar, as it's known today. Now, what happens next is that Khalil Beg is caught in a catch-22 situation. His opponents inform the incumbent emperor Shah Jahan that he's got these two fine horses for you. Shah Jahan demands those horses, but Shah Jahan does not know that, the Sikhs have retrieved their guru's property. So, feeling he still has the time, Khalil Beg decides that he's going to dispatch his two cousin brothers, Kamar Beg and Lal Beg, to, obtain those horses and destroy the Sikhs. Now, obviously, Guru Hargobind Sahibji receives intelligence of this. He vacates Amritsar straight away, leaves it, evacuates it, leaves the Darbar Sahib and starts strategically retreating in front of the Beg brothers. Obviously, they're fixated on him and he lures them away until near Bathinda, Sahibzada Tegh Bahadur leads a very deadly ambush, and in a matter of hours, the Begs are annihilated and their forces as well. So, this is the first incident, the first mention of Sahibzada Tegh Bahadur in history. And mind you, his organizational skills, his leadership skills, his strategy, his tactics, they not only won this battle, but another subsequent battle near Nathana. So from the start, the name Tegh Bahadur is well earned.
Okay, a side point here.
Yes.
in your entire life, have you ever come across anybody or a name, let's say of your maybe an old man or grandfather, great grandfather, whose name was Tyag? Tyag Seng or
No.
Tyag Kaur?
No, not in my life. Not even in my grandfather's life. I've actually asked him this question. He actually arrived from Pakistan in 47, so no, not in his life as well.
Well, that's what I'm trying to make. These names do not exist in our civilization.
In our Sikh civilization, obviously. Now, the next thing is, in 1635, that's when Guru Tegh Bahadur again, or Bhai Tegh Bahadur, comes to the fore when he defeats Mir Badera and Kale Khan, two of Pende Khan's foremost captains in the Battle of Jalandhar, where Pende Khan attempted to slay Guru Har Gobind. So that's the third mention of the warrior Tegh Bahadur. Now, a bit of a backdrop to all these issues. The incumbent emperor is Shah Jahan, and Shah Jahan has, you know, multiple children from Mumtaz. Two of the
13,
sons,
who I think.
Yes. So two of the children who stand out. The first is Dara Shikoh, who's actually intended for the imperial throne. And the second one is one of the youngest ones, and that is Aurangzeb. Now, let's remember, these children were once held, especially the boys, they were actually once held hostage by Shah Jahan's father, Jahangir, when he mutinied against his father for the imperial throne. And during this time, Aurangzeb actually came in contact with Khwaja Muhammad Masoom. Now, Masoom was the son of Ahmad Shah Sirhindi. Now, you know the common strain interlinking Al-Qaeda, Wahhabi Islam, ISIS, and all these fundamental branches of Sunni Islam?
Mm-hmm.
That is the Naqshbandi school of thought, which was founded in India.
True.
And the Naqshbandis were founded by Sheikh Ahmad Shah Sirhindi, who actually believed he was going to be the regenerator of the second millennium of Islam, who was going to herald the age of paradise as far as the Quranic version of it was concerned, that Islam would rule all over the world and subdue infidelity. So he was born in Sirhind. Obviously, he was a religious demagogue, and he acquired the patronage of Murtaza Khan, who was the governor of Lahore. Lahore being one of the foremost parts of the Mughal subcontinental empire, this allowed him to have direct access to Prince Salim, who was Jahangir, and who at the time was Akbar's very rebellious son. Now, to incite his father, Salim had one of his primary retainers murdered for questioning the Prophet Muhammad. Now, as far as Akbar was concerned, Akbar also questioned the Prophet Muhammad. Akbar questioned everyone and everything under the sun. But the Islamic orthodoxy could not, you know, withstand this. Salim fell into their hands. Now, of course, Islam says you can't criticize your Islamic ruler, even if he's an alcoholic. So Salim pretty much calculated his chances that if he agreed with Sirhindi that they would get him the throne of India as long as he let them do what they wanted politically, he had nothing to lose. And that's exactly what happened. So these two, Murtaza Khan and Sirhindi, played a prominent role in having Akbar murdered. Salim put on the imperial throne as Jahangir. And obviously we know that in those early years of Jahangir's reign, there was a whole policy of terror imposed upon the subcontinent. There was open cow slaughter. There was open destruction of temples and dharamsalas. Basically, if you were not a Sunni Muslim, you were in for it.
What's new?
Obviously, what's new? And Sirhindi played a very pivotal, very prominent role in having Guru Arjan executed as well. And I guess if he's alive somewhere, he's probably turning in whatever hell he is in, realizing that almost, you know, nearly a century to two centuries later, Banda Singh Bahadur attacked the place of his birth and forbade the Sikhs from burning down his mosque just to spite his memory that, look, you destroyed all places of worship. We won't destroy the mosque you built. Rather, we will leave it as a sign of your patheticness, of how pathetic you were in life.
Yep, true.
Obviously, political correctness does not allow people to look that far, but anyway, what happened with Sirhindi was Murtaza Khan died in the field of battle. He attacked Guru Har Gobind out of frustration. And it's said that Guru Har Gobind was standing looking down at one of his wounded soldiers, actually Pende Khan. And he was bent down. He had a shield on his arm when Murtaza Khan suddenly rushed upon him. Guru Har Gobind saw him out of the corner of his eye, his peripheral vision, rose, blocked his Vaad, pivoted around on his heel, and then suddenly started, launching his own attacks with his kirpan on Murtaza Khan. These two fought back and forth until Murtaza Khan attempted to stab him. The guru sidestepped and then with one blow of his sword, decapitated him right there and then.
You also have to remember that Guru Har Gobind Sahib was a physically imposing figure.
Very imposing, the tallest and the most muscular out of the Dasa Patshahiya, Guru Har Gobind.
I'm not too sure about the records, or maybe the system of height we use wasn't invented back then, but I've heard from many, many people that he was nearly 7 feet tall. And I was like,
Possibly.
maybe not that tall, but he was a very imposing figure. He required two horses to ride on.
Yes, very, very imposing figure and ambidextrous. He was able to use a kirpan proficiently in both hands.
So that's true, yeah.
Another thing we need to remember down here is that we'll just touch upon it now that we're discussing it, the stupid myth that the Rajputs trained the Sikhs. This is all rubbish. Guru Arjan was the first one to raise the embryonic Sikh army. After him, the gurus always had a template. They never had any Rajputs help them raise any army.
Could we say that the second guru was a wrestler?
Well, I believe that the first guru, Guru Nanak, would have been a warrior himself as well. He would have participated in the defense of Sedpur with the kirpan. That's what I believe.
Yep. Of course, there is a very strong possibility. But I was thinking that if you start, let's say, a tradition of wrestling, it's not going away anytime soon.
No, I mean, I don't believe this would have been conventional wrestling. This would have been like grappling war, battlefield grappling, for self-defense.
Of course, not enough competition for self-defense. I think they pretty much knew what was coming in the next decades, or maybe in the next century.
Yes. So basically, now what happens to Sirhindi? That's a question which history has as well. Now, what Sardar Kapoor Singh actually discovered in his researches was Sirhindi was in the habit of having Jahangir's poets executed. And there was one poet in particular who used to write a very perverted and horny verses which Jahangir liked. And Sirhindi was caught out by his own hand. Now, Sirhindi used to preach that we got Arjan the Kafir killed because he questioned our caliphate and our glorious ruler Jahangir. And he decided to have Jahangir's favorite poet, writer of the horny verses, executed. And suddenly Jahangir turned upon him. Now, Jahangir knew that, executing Sirhindi openly would do no good. So what he did was he threw Sirhindi in a jail. And that's where Sirhindi died like a rabid dog, pretty much. So in a way, the mighty had truly fallen. And it's said
Well,
that the, yep.
I've heard of the satanic verses, the satanic verses from Rushdie, but the
Yep.
holy verses—that's a first for me.
Well, it's also believed that there was a massive coincidence because the day Sirhindi was thrown into prison, that's the day Guru Har Gobind Sahib Ji was released from Gwalior.
Ah, okay, that cannot be a coincidence.
So obviously, it might have been Jahangir deciding to sort of just highlight the irony of the situation to Sirhindi as well, because really it would have been a massive slap in his face. Sirhindi used to believe Guru Arjan was the foremost enemy of Islam. He used to lose sleep over the fact that Guru Arjan was alive.
He must have his reasons, because we have to remember that the establishment of Amritsar as a city that was in control of the Sikhs, that would have been a major headache.
That would have been a major headache. And the fact that Guru Arjan was also armed and a warrior as well, even though he didn't participate in any combat. Now, Khwaja Muhammad Masum is Sirhindi's son. He's pretty much a hostage down there at the Mughal camp. And what happens is that Shah Jahan has pretty much forgotten the past and he's decided that, look, if the Naqshbandis want to help us, let them help us. And even Shah Jahan had a fanatical streak. So what happens is that Aurangzeb and Muhammad Masum strike up a friendship. And it's believed that initially Masum was only following Jahangir's camp because he had no other means of income, given that his father was in jail and his father's disciples were being hunted down. Anyhow, Masoom and Aurangzeb strike up a friendship, and that's where Masoom inculcates Aurangzeb into the Naqshbandi cult, and from there, Aurangzeb's fanaticism starts.
What a great name, Masoom.
Masoom. Now, what happens is, in the meantime, Guru Hargobind Sahib Ji is at Kiritpur. He knows that the Sikhs will be, you know, in the future, the Gurus will be finding the Khalsa. There will be massive battles. What he does is he vacates Amritsar because the open plains aren't conducive to the strategy the Sikhs will have to adopt, which is of guerrilla warfare and ambush tactics. So he departs for the foothills of the Himalayas. In the Shivalik Hills, he finds Kiritpur. And that's where he officiates the son of Bhai Gurditta, the youngest son of Bhai Gurditta. Harai is the seventh Nanak of the Sikhs. Now, when Guru Harai assumes his, you know, incumbency, now the first thing is, you know, in the history books we have, Guru Harai probably has two pages dedicated to him at the most.
Yep, not much is known now, true.
Not much is known, except the thing is that upon, you know, ascending to Guruship, Guru Harai confronted a lot of, you know, menaces. He had the Masands to deal with, he had Tirmal, who was his, you know, elder brother, Prithi Chand's son, Meherban. He had the Naqshbandis who were in the resurgent. He had a lot of elements to confront, a lot of factions. And primarily the one individual who assisted him in the Punjab and beyond was Bhai Tegh Bahadur, who was based in Bakala at the time. So obviously there is a myth that, you know, Guru Tegh Bahadur spent 26 saal, 26 years in Apora. This is a myth. There is no reality to it. This myth has been exposed many times before. I mean, if we talk about a Gurdwara where the Pora is actually built well, then we need to read Captain Bagh Singh and Mool Singh Chima's analysis of multiple Gurdwaras in Pakistan and Bangladesh, which were constructed with a false history.
Okay. to think that the if let's say Guru Sahib spent 26 years in a basement, or as a basement here.
Yes.
So that would mean that he stayed away from Sikh activities for 26 years.
For 26 years. So why would you make him Guru?
Yeah. Well, that's point number one.
Yes.
And if you are staying away for 26 years in such a tumultuous time, in modern times, this will amount to treason.
This would amount to treason. Now, the third point I would like to point out here, and I'm sure you will agree with me on this. It is said in Gurbani that the Guru is a physical form of Waheguru. So, when you have a Guru, when you have the Guru, Sikh Gurus who are argued to be the most perfect of perfect, why would that Guru spend 26 years doing tapasya in Apora to merge with Waheguru, when it said that they're already one with Waheguru from the start?
Well, you're using logic. In a religion, their logic is like a kryptonite.
If you're saying there's predestination, if you're saying there's fast karma, everything, so everything points towards Guru Tegh Bahadur becoming Guru, so why would he be doing tapasya in Apora?
Absolutely no answer to this point. No answer. You'll probably receive a beating or something, but no answer.
Okay, leaving aside the beating part, hopefully not. Anyhow, Guru Harai is being assisted by Guru Tegh Bahadur. So Guru Tegh Bahadur or Bhai Tegh Bahadur at this stage informs Guru Harai that, look, the Punjab is under the vice royalty of Dara Shikoh. He's a liberal. Come down. And Guru Harai actually does come to the Punjab and he converts thousands to Sikhi in Amritsar, Dwaba and Malwa.
Yep, now, my family.
Yes. So afterwards, what happens is that when Guru Harai departs, Dara is recalled to Delhi. Now, he's a liberal as well, so Punjab is at peace under him. And Dara's very, very intrigued by Guru Harai. He meets Guru Harai, and he's very interested in Guru Harai's views. And what Dara feels is that while there are fundamental and unbreachable differences between Sikhi and Islam, Sikhi is possibly something which can entail progression for the subcontinent, and Guru Harai can usher in a new era, men like Guru Harai. So what happens is that when he's called back to Delhi, he actually falls afoul of Aurangzeb and Masoom, and they decide to poison his food. Now, the poison, it's believed, is made out of tiger's viscers, and these pretty much cause internal bleeding in Dara's, physicality. So all these internal problems plague him. However, when the doctors succeed in healing him, the pain does not go away. So to avail the pain, the physicians inform Shah Jahan that they need a certain variety of herbs which are only found in Kiratpur and the surrounding areas, and those areas are under the command of Guru Har Rai and his Akali warriors. Now, Shah Jahan decides to adopt some tact. Obviously, he's confronted Guru Har Gobind Sahib Ji in the past and been defeated. So this time he decides, look, he's had enough of war. Contemporary English sources from the men who actually met him, English merchants, point out that he had become too old, could not see, and he had lost the martial spirit which had defined his earlier years. So he dispatches a very diplomatic request to Guru Har Rai. Now, obviously, many Sikhs advise Guru Har Rai that, look, he's our enemy. He will be our enemy. Why not avenge Guru Arjan's, martyrdom and the troubles Guru Har Gobind confronted by letting his son die? Guru Har Rai, however, has enough foresight to put aside all personal vendettas, and he tells them, if Dara dies, there goes our hope of having a progressive polity. We will save his life, and that's exactly what happens. He gives that herb to the Mughal couriers, and they take it to Delhi, where Dara's life is saved. He's grateful to Guru Har Rai. Shah Jahan is grateful to Guru Har Rai. And in the meantime, the policy of, viewing the Sikhs with hostility is dismantled by Delhi.
Now, okay, here. Let's stop for a moment and think. All these political maneuvers, from where would have they learned it? Okay, this is a very important point. So you were able to think critically. You were able to put your personal vendettas aside. And you were able to politically maneuver a much, much stronger opponent, adversary, I'm not going to use the word, into such a position exactly where you wanted them. Yeah? So do you think that these skills can be acquired by sitting in a pura for 26 years?
No.
So this is Guru Har Rai, yeah?
Yes, this is Guru Har Rai. But even it's made out that even Guru Har Rai used to go in a pura. That's what's said as well today.
But Guru Tegh Bahadur would also have needed to learn the same thing.
The same thing. He
Politics.
was, after all, advising Guru Har Rai from the Punjab as to what the situation was. He was closer to Delhi than Guru Har Rai.
Correct. And he had actively engaged in battles, physical battles.
Yes.
So all those skills, they don't come out of nowhere, sitting in a pura. You sit in a pura for 26 years, you can't even walk straight.
No.
If you sit for extended periods of time, I've seen old babas and old grandees, they all, without exception, have got bent knees. They can't walk.
They walk like ducks.
Well, I was going to say turtles, but too slow, but ducks is, yeah, that's also a Well, no, I'm trying to
No.
imagine them with wings and stuff. They already wear white, yeah, with like a duck.
Now, what happens next is that in 1657, Shah Jahan becomes very ill. And this is when Aurangzeb strikes and takes over the throne with the Naqshbandis at his back. So he takes over Delhi, he imprisons Shah Jahan in the Red Fort. And what happens afterwards is that Shah Jahan, imprisoned in the Red Fort, Aurangzeb declares Dara an apostate from Islam. And we know the punishment for apostasy in Islam is death.
That's
So Dara actually flees. He collects a few rebellious Rajputs around him. And what happens is that he decides to confront Aurangzeb in a pitched battle, which is a very big mistake. And at the Battle of Samugarh in 1658, he is defeated decisively by Aurangzeb. So what happens is that he flees and he collects three men to spot him, three of the most dangerous men on the subcontinent for Aurangzeb. So the first is Mian Mir's successor, Mulay Shah. The third is Muhammad Said Sarmad, who's a Jew converted to Islam. And then obviously the third one is Guru Har Rai. Now, Dara is defeated by Aurangzeb on several other occasions. So what happens is that he decides to escape with an ad hoc military. Now, the problem is Mulay Shah has a lot of followers, but he doesn't have any military experience. Sarmad is a one-man show, so this only leaves Guru Harai as his foremost military ally. So what happens is that Dara flees to Roppar. Aurangzeb nearly corners him, Aurangzeb's captains nearly corner him down there, and now he has to traverse the river at Roppar. There's one single bridge which will allow him to cross the river, him and his army. So what he does is he sends a message for aid to Guru Harai. And what happens, Navjeet, is Guru Harai actually comes down. Now, Guru Harai has Guru Tegh Bahadur providing him the valuable intelligence by Tegh Bahadur. So Guru Harai comes down with 2,200 Akalis from Kiratpur, and they have a brief skirmish with the Mughals, allowing Dara to cross the bridge. And afterwards, the Sikhs destroy that bridge.
Yep, the ropes were cut off, yeah.
The ropes were cut off. So what happens next is that now from Kiratpur, the Sikhs can circumvent their way to Lahore, but the Mughals can't. So the Mughals obviously have to retreat. So this is when Guru Harai actually returns to Kiratpur, and from there they actually make their way to Lahore, where a pro-Dara coalition is gathering. But we need to remember Dara is not a very proficient general. The Guru sees that, he's a man who's struck by fear at the, in front of death. This man can't really be as progressive as, it was believed he was. So slowly his allies leave him, and Guru Harai is the first one to leave. So the Guru asks him that, look, if you want to flee to Kandahar, now is the best time to do it. If you don't, we can collect more allies and fight for you as long as you have a heart in the fight. Obviously, Dara is shaken by this, and he decides that he's going to flee to Kandahar and make his way to Persia. Unfortunately, Aurangzeb corners him, and he's killed. So this obviously leaves Guru Harai as the last man standing in the field of battle. Mulay Shah is exiled from the subcontinent. Sarmad is executed by Masum, and Guru Harai is the only one out of the three who's safe at Kiratpur.
Question for you.
Yep.
Does this act of, let's say, rebelling against the Emperor of India, Aurangzeb, would have to do anything with the passing away of the Guru Sahib at such a young age?
Okay, so let's progress on, and that question will be answered. Now, what happens is that Aurangzeb dispatches his army, a portion of his army, to capture the Guru three times. Obviously, there is a story that the Guru performed three miracles, but it's more than likely the Sikhs were, following the Guru's instructions. So the first time, pestilence broke out in the Mughal camp, and the soldiers died from malaria. So the commander decided to beat a retreat. Obviously, this could be a form of biological warfare initiated by the Sikhs. The second time, it said the commander is actually killed while he's sleeping. So this was assassination, most likely arranged by the Sikhs.
A surgical strike, you
Third,
might say.
surgical strike. And the third time, most of the commanders and their chiefs, their veterans, are killed due to poisoned food. So this was probably the third surgical strike. So the fourth time around, now Aurangzeb himself being superstitious, he dispatches an edict to Guru Harai that, please come to Delhi and let's just sort this out. He's not actually expressing fanaticism as he would later in his reign, because let's remember he's actually new to the throne, so he's consolidating his grip still. So what happens is Guru Harai hears this message and refuses, saying, I'm not going there, but just to concede a bit of ground to Aurangzeb, I'll send my elder son Ram Rai to deal with him. And we know what happens next, don't we?
We all know what happens next.
Yep. Ram Rai willfully changes the Asa Diwar, and obviously the Guru disowns him right there and then. And the works of historian Ajit Singh Bagga in the early 20th century, he visited the Ram Raiya Dera at Dehradun, and he actually visited a Tibetan ruins near Kiratpur. And from them, he actually managed to collect primary sources which pointed out that Guru Harai was most likely poisoned by Ram Rai sympathizers on Aurangzeb's orders.
My question has been answered.
Yep, now obviously you have the, Suraj Prakash with its tale that the Guru married seven women, with the youngest being a toddler. That was never the case. He was only ever married to one woman in his life, one Sikh woman. And the second thing was that, you know, obviously Kavi Santokh Singh says that the Guru saw his wife's handmaiden and couldn't, you know, resist, couldn't control himself. And Ram Rai was born out of wedlock. That's why he was not made the Guru. All these are rubbish stories. Reality is that the Guru never actually released his breath from the Dasam Dwar as it's made out, or that he got hukam from Vaheguru to leave the world. That was never the case. He was actually poisoned. That's what Ajit Singh Bagga confirmed. But the theory, or, you know, that substance, that evidence never took off because people did not want to accept it.
Yep, and if you believe that Guru Sahib was poisoned, then your entire view changes about those events in the 17th and 18th century.
Those events, but the thing is, Guru Har Rai
had 16th.
Yep. Another thing which this explains is that why Guru Har Rai acted so promptly to officiate Guru Har Krishan as Guru. He had foreseen the eventuality of his own death.
These are the things that a Sikh should think about deeply. Yeah?
Yes, yes.
But these, what I mean to say is that these things have been happening. These things have happened to Guru Sahib. These are very earthly things. Assassinations, jealousy, treachery, backstabbing. These are very humane things. You know, they're not associated with divinity or heaven or maybe Vaheguru or something. These are very, very human qualities, bad human qualities.
Now, what happens is that Guru Har Krishan is Guru, but his secret guardian from behind the stage is Guru Pai Tegh Bahadur all along.
Yep, true.
Now, obviously, we have the fact that there is the 1661-1666 discrepancy between Guru Gobind Singh's date of birth. The reality is that 1666 would make sense if the Pora myth is upheld, which it isn't, which it isn't by historical sources.
So basic mathematics, yeah?
Yep, basic mathematics. So basically, we also need to remember that Raja Jai Singh and Ram Singh, who were Guru Har Krishan's protectors in Delhi for the time he was there, they were on the Sikh payroll. That's why they actually rushed to protect the Gurus. So when Guru Har Krishan dies, as he's about to die, now the myth is that he smashed a coconut and said, Baba Bakara. The reality is that a day before, he collected a council of, you know, trustworthy, loyal Sikhs, veteran Sikhs, and confirmed to them who his successor would be.
Well, that's more likely to happen. A guru cannot give such a vague direction or a vague order.
Now, the Makhan Shah Lubana tale that Makhan Shah Lubana prayed for the Guru to come over, the Guru swam over, lifted up the ship from the sandbar. Fine, then, okay, let's accept the Guru's able to, you know, cross time and space in less than a few nanoseconds. How was Makhan Shah Lubana, whose ship was said to have, you know, docked at Calcutta, able to come to Punjab in a matter of few weeks and then find the Guru and start shouting, Guru Ladiore, Guru Ladiore, Guru Ladiore?
The very first thing is, how much time would it have taken for the news to reach him?
That's the thing. That's the thing. So, no, the reality is that when Guru Har Rai actually, or Guru Har Krishan actually signaled his decision, obviously, word would have leaked out, or, you know, they would have said that the next Guru, the council upon his, you know, demise, would have said the next Guru is at Bakara. We had the 20 Saudis run up and set up their manjis claiming to be Gurus to fool the incredulous. Now, obviously, this would have all been allowed by Aurangzeb. Now, let's remember all this Lord Tir, Mal Ram Rai, all the Saudis, they were under Aurangzeb. They had joined forces with him. What, however, happens next is the council comes along and says that there is one person at Bakara who is the Guru. And that is Tegh Bahadur, who was supposedly at Delhi, but who had secretly returned to Bakara. Because being in Delhi for him would have been dangerous. He could not have been officiated as a Guru in Delhi. Not when Aurangzeb was directly next to him. So he's declared as Guru. The Saudis flee and the Delhi court is left gnashing its teeth at being outsmarted by a child like Guru Hare Krishan. So the next few years we see of Guru Tegh Bahadur's incumbency, they prove very decisive in the lead up to the manifestation of the Khalsa. So rather than make this voluminous and focus on all the minor details, let's just cover a brief period of Guru Tegh Bahadur's life before moving on to the gist. As Guru, he liberated Darbar Sahib from the clutches of the Hindu pujaris who had actually installed idols therein. The masands refused to help him, but their wives helped him. He traveled far and wide, converting thousands to Sikhi, consolidating the Sangat. And then he also laid the foundation for Anandapur at the Makhowal ruins in the Shivalik Hills.
Yeah, true.
Now, in mid-1666, Aurangzeb decided that he wanted a measure of Tegh Bahadur. They said that this is the son of Har Gobind, and Aurangzeb was well conversant with his father's battles. He had probably, organized the logistics for the armies which had gone to battle Guru Har Gobind, so he knew what the Sikhs were made out of. And the Naqshbandis had foremost enemies, and these were Sikhs. So Aurangzeb orders Alam Khan Rohila to arrest Guru Tegh Bahadur, who's actually hunting in the jungles near Delhi. So what happens is the Guru is arrested, brought to Delhi. Obviously, there's a contingency plan if the Guru is killed prematurely. But what happens is that, Ram Singh, Jai Singh, already on the Sikh payroll, they tell the Guru that this is just a test. He wants to arrest you, put you in jail for some time, spread rumors that he's about to kill you, incite some sort of a reaction from the Sikhs so he can crush them openly without having to fear the fact that, some other factions might rise up against him. Because we need to remember this is still the consolidation period for Aurangzeb. He's not fully consolidated his incumbency. Guru Tegh Bahadur intimates all this to the Sikhs. The Sikhs refuse to take the bait. And after a few months, Aurangzeb, who's fooled into believing that the Sikhs have called in Guru Tegh Bahadur, is only a, fighter and has, no intelligence like his father, Aurangzeb lets him go. Now, these events coincide with another very peculiar set of events. And that is the rise of the Marathas. And the two are interlinked quite considerably. Now, are you aware that the Marathas initially were never free but had overlords?
True.
And do you know who these overlords were?
Well, we all know who these overlords were. The Pathans.
Yeah, the Southern Pathans. Now, they were always a thorn in the Mughal side because the Mughals wanted to pave their way to the Deccan, and to do so, they would have to reduce the Pathans who would otherwise have, destroyed their supply lines. So now the thing is that these Bijapur Pathans, they employed the Marathas as mercenaries, had been doing so for centuries. And Shaji Raja Bhonsle, who was Shivaji's father, and Shivaji as well himself, they had taken part in ruthless expeditions directed against their own Hindu compatriots. So they had, lead the first attack during the Karnataka expedition in which countless Hindu temples were destroyed and, the peasantry and the Hindu elite put down very barbarically.
Keeping that in your memory that Aurangzeb wasted 25 years fighting in the Deccan. 25 years.
25 years fighting in the Deccan. And that was actually one of the Mughal dreams to conquer Deccan and, open the routes to South India. Anyhow, what happens is that the Bijapur Sultanate, Shaji dies and Shivaji is entrusted with Maratha command. He's very weak, very indecisive. And he, let's just say the word would be, pisses off or insults Afsal Khan, his Pathan overlord. Obviously, Khan clashes with Shivaji and Shivaji assassinates him with a Bagh Naka or that, that tiger claw as that famous painting depicts. Now, unbeknownst to Shivaji, Afsal Khan's successors have already, formed a coalition with Aurangzeb. Aurangzeb dispatches Shaistha Khan to, bring Shivaji to reign. Shaistha Khan is a very astute naval commander, unable to fight on land. Shivaji defeats him, but in turn, Jai Singh arrives and destroys the entire Maratha cavalry. Shivaji submits to him, and then subsequently, Jai Singh actually makes an appointment between Shivaji and Aurangzeb because Shivaji, based on a primary letter, which is if I understand correctly, preserved in either the Delhi Museum or the Maharashtra Museum, because it's also mentioned by Besom in his biography of Shivaji, which is accepted as being the most authentic biography of Shivaji historically. In that letter, Shivaji mentions to Aurangzeb, requests Aurangzeb that, can you please allow me to obtain Kandhar for you, that by own resources I want to become your vassal.
You're going to piss off a lot of people, bro.
Now, obviously, Aurangzeb is very suspicious, very, very suspicious, because he knows the relationship between Shivaji and Afzal Khan had deteriorated. So he decides to imprison Shivaji. What happens is that Shivaji is imprisoned and Shivaji escapes. Now, Shivaji was supposed to be, heavily guarded by Raja Ram Singh, Jai Singh's son. So Shivaji naturally escapes. And what happens is that a very pissed off Aurangzeb decides to depute Ram Singh to fight the Ahoms in modern day Bengal. Now, the fact is that the Ahoms are actually in a very plagued down region. They are actually, fighting a battle of attrition with the Mughals. There's been no subsequent or, any consequential, victory for them. So what's happened is that the Mughals are at a stalemate. The Ahoms are at a stalemate. Ram Singh's given command of 6,700 Mughal Rajput soldiers, but he also is aware that the Rajputs, his Rajputs, are very jealous of his position, and they're preparing to stab him in the back. So he approaches his father, Jai Singh, to advise him what to do. So we have two primary sources here. The first is a letter written by Ram Singh, kept in the Patna Museum. Now, this was directed to Guru Tegh Bahadur, and it said that, your father had released some of the forefathers of these Rajputs who are planning to do me in. Can you broker a peace between us? And the second near contemporary source was written during Banda Singh Bahadur's time by a Rajput agent at the Mughal court in Delhi. And that also mentions that, Ram Singh requested Guru Tegh Bahadur, who agreed to accompany him to the east. Of note down here is the fact that, like the trolls today are promoting, based on Hariram Gupta's assertions, the Guru was never an employee of the Mughals.
An employee of the Mughals. What an
Look,
insult.
these two sources, these two primary sources confirm that. And Guru Tegh Bahadur agreed because he was already preparing to go to the east to consolidate the Sangats down there on the condition that Ram Singh prevent any untoward incident transpiring between him and the Mughals. Point number one, that he wasn't a Mughal employee, and two, he would depart before the bulk of the Mughals arrived. Point number two, which proves he wasn't an employee. And that's exactly what transpired. The Guru brokered a temporary truce, and from there he departed to go elsewhere in modern day Bangladesh. Now, obviously, Captain Bagh Singh and Mool Singh Chima and many other historians have actually, confirmed the fact that a majority of these Gurdwaras in Pakistan and Bangladesh aren't related with the Gurus. They have been built, falsely to loot the Sanghats. Only a few are actually, authentic. Anyhow,
Not only
what
in
we see.
Bangladesh, mate. Not only in Bangladesh.
Now, of course, the Bachitra Natak we know mentions that the Guru went to all these different pilgrimage sites and made pilgrims, and that's how Guru Gobind Singh was born. That's why I mentioned this point, because even if there are Gurdwaras down there, they need to be analyzed carefully for their history. Why would Guru Tegh Bahadur make all these pilgrims when he made multiple copies of the Guru Granth, and each of these facsimiles, all these beards have Bhakt Ramanand Shabad, that there is no use in going to pilgrimage sites?
Aren't you expecting too much out of an average Sikh today?
Well, I mean, here's one more point. Here's one more bomb. I mean, Dr. Gurbakh Singh from Ontario once went to India, and he actually went to Benares, and down there is a Gurdwara. The Granthi recited a katha that one day a Sikh asked Guru Tegh Bahadur while he was at Benares, "How can I have darshan of you?" And the Guru told him, "Lift that stone." The Sikh lifted that stone, and Ganga came out. And the guru said, have a bath in this water of Ganga. Now, there's a sarovar in the Gurdwara, obviously man-made, which is claimed to be Ganga. Dr. Gurbakh Singh asked the Granthi something. Now, this was, obviously after the 80s. So he said, are Sikhs Hindus? And the Granthi said, no. So he said, why didn't you guys say that, the Sikh lifted the stone and Amritsar Sarovar came out? What say you?
Well, the very first thing, I can only laugh. And the second thing is, how devoid of intelligence could that Granthi be? That he never asked himself this question. That we are Sikhs, Ganga has got no importance for us.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely none. Well,
none. None at all. No.
Do remember that even if they said that Amritsar Sarovar is here, even if they had said that, would that make sense?
No.
So it's just a Gurdwara for income. So Sikhs are strong in their faith. So let's build a Gurdwara, guaranteed income.
Guaranteed income. Now, coming back to what's happening here is that Guru Tegh Bahadur is actually returning from Bengal. He's consolidated the Sangats down there. He knows that the Panth can very nearly be wiped out in the Punjab. And if it does, at least the Sikhs outside the Punjab will keep on fighting for Sikhi. Now, as he's returning, he's informed of, latest developments on the subcontinent. So what's actually happened is around the early 1600s, and Thomas Rowell, the English president of a factory at Surat, would, note in his memoirs in 1679, and so would the contemporary Italian mercenary Manucci, or Manucci, as his name is, variably mentioned. They would note that Aurangzeb actually reintroduced the jizya, the, infidelity tax. So if you're a non-Muslim, you have to pay it. Infidelity was made akin to treason against the state. So if you were a Muslim, you were a citizen. If you weren't, you were a traitor to the state, even if you hadn't carried out any seditious acts. Same time as Manushi or Manuki notes, many Hindus who were unable to pay turned Mohammedan, Aurangzeb rejoices. And then the works of the fundamentalist Qadi, the Muslim judge Moghith of Bayana, circa 13th century, they were already introduced to the mainstream. And Moghith had this to say about, the tax collectors: the payee should remain polite even if the tax collector spits in his mouth. And this actually became a practice. So if they came to collect a jizya, they would spit in your mouth just to, impose themselves on you.
Okay, I'd like to give, well, it's an example, but it's a true example. It could be taken as a source. Okay.
Yep.
In the Nawanshahr district of Punjab, there is a village called Jadla.
Yes.
Even today, Hindu Kodewa Rajputs live there.
Yes.
A branch of Kodewa Rajputs had converted to Islam back in the time when Aurangzeb was a ruler, because only a Muslim could own property.
Hmm.
So let's say one brother embraced Islam, then he got the property. And then after Aurangzeb passed away, his Hindu brothers joined him on his property. That's how that village was founded. So this is an evidence of Aurangzeb's policies, that one can go to Nawanshahr Jadla village today and talk to the elders and they will tell you the exact same story.
And that's only one example.
One example is enough. You can have more examples, but I've given you one example that you can go today and verify.
That's right. Now, so what happens is that from around 1661, we know from 1661, Aurangzeb had started the spontaneous state-sponsored bouts of temple destruction. And in 1662, a Hindu temple at Mathura was demolished and supplanted with a mosque. From 1665 to 1666 to 1668, these became routine. Temple demolitions, blanket ban on non-Muslim festivals. And in 1669, the orders were given that, the entire non-Islamic heritage of India had to be destroyed. So the Jats initially arose to confront the Mughals, but they were brought to heel with 5,000 slain, 7,000 enslaved, And to exacerbate this injury, a temple they had built at Mathura was destroyed and its idols placed beneath the steps of a mosque. Now, at the same time, let's remember the Sikhs had a dog in this fight as well. Aurangzeb particularly targeted them, and this is a history which is always hidden from us. He established Mutasibs, or centers for Islamic morals, and these were made to specially target Gurdwaras. Now, the contemporary observer Mirza Inayatullah Khan, he records that Aurangzeb specifically ordered a Gurdwara demolished in the region of Sirhind. The site was then made over to Darvesh Said Zafar, who constructed a rudimentary mosque on the ruins of the Gurdwara and commenced publicly humiliating the Sikhs. Now, in retaliation, given that there was no justice forthcoming, several Sikhs assassinated Zafar. And Aurangzeb ordered a whole widespread scale massacre of the Sikhs and their expulsion because of this.
That's something that I don't even know. I've heard about this incident, but I know nothing about it.
So what happens is that all this convinces Guru Tegh Bahadur he has to return to the Punjab, and he does. And from there, what he does is he shifts his family to the village of Lucknow and then directs them to go to Anandapur, which is newly finished. After that, from 1672 to 1675, he actually keeps abreast of all the, happenings on the subcontinent. Meanwhile, Mughal intelligence has its eyes right on him. We have the Satnami Rebellion. Now, the Satnamis were not Hindus in any, sense of the term. They were Sikh sympathizers, and it was the Sikh ideology which convinced them to, rebel against the Mughals. Unfortunately, they lost, and the survivors were, left to limp off into the jungles of central India, where they fell prey to caste elitists. Today, their descendants are in Glasgow, and that's where I believe they have one of the authentic beards of the Guru Granth Sahib, created by Guru Tegh Bahadur himself.
Yep, I know that one.
So in 1674, Aurangzeb arrives in the Punjab to subdue the Afridi Cuttack revolt. He orders his Islamic governors to, exterminate infidelity from the Punjab. Now, at the same time, Guru Tegh Bahadur is giving his clarion call of fear not, frighten not. Anandapur has opened its doors to multiple refugees. The Sikhs are training for war. All this Aurangzeb is aware of. Only thing is that he doesn't attack the Sikhs because they're in a mountainous stronghold. Now, the question is, why did the Guru never confront the Mughals militarily?
Well, it doesn't make any sense to do so.
Several answers. The first is Sikhi was close to a ratification phase and could not forfeit its socio-spiritual / religio-political figurehead on the field of battle. It was, too early for him to die. He couldn't die. His leadership was still important. Second was that the Mughal military machine had increased and Guru Tegh Bahadur lacked any viable allies and the Sikh forces went really big in number. Third is unable to fight a pitched battle. The only mode of warfare he could undertake was guerrilla warfare, and this would force him into the jungles of Punjab where he would be hemmed in by the Mughals. And then we have the most crucial one. Shivaji was warring for autonomy but was prepared to surrender if Aurangzeb incorporated him within the Mughal military. Rajputs only warred for personal gain. Sikhs, meanwhile, were preparing to incite an hitherto unseen revolution against the state, and the Guru could not risk its premature demise by confronting the Mughals. The stakes were more higher for him than they were for the Marathas and the Rajputs.
So, yeah, that these reasons that, well, all of us should know, but these reasons, they sound very viable and very justified.
Now, what happens is that now, obviously, there's certain species of trolls we are talking about targeting the Guru. They will resort to anything to disprove Sikh history. Obviously, one of these idiots actually mentioned that the Gurbilas doesn't mention Kashmiri Pandits visiting, Anandapur. The Gurbilas, he used the same edition, same publishing date. We acquired it and double-checked it, and it actually did. So far, we are still to hear back from him, but we have, forfeited any hope that this idiot will reply back. Now, what happens is that this time around, Aurangzeb mandates Sher Afghan Khan, his primary governor in North India, with ridding both Kashmir and the Punjab of infidelity. Now, this is what happens. Kashmiri Pandits, who are the foremost Brahmin intellectuals in the subcontinent, the foremost preservers of Hindu heritage, they are the first ones to be targeted. And Aurangzeb has actually done a very strategic thing down here. He's decided that, look, if I go for the brains, the body will follow suit. I'll go for the pandits straight away, as they're the brains of the Hindu faith. Now, here's the funny thing. The pandits sat down, assessed the situation. The Marathas did not stand in good stead with them, nor did the Rajputs. But if you're fickle enough to convert for their own gain, this only left one recourse. They decided that they would petition Guru Tegh Bahadur to lift the sword to protect them, to lead the Sikhs to die for them, for their preservation. Now, the Patwahiya and Kashmiri Pandit records record that a 15-man Pandit deputation arrived at Anandpur on 25th May 1675. They were received by the Guru in his court. What happens next is open to debate. I don't believe that Guru Tegh Bahadur would have suddenly said to the Pandits, "Okay, look, I'm ready to die for you. We just said the stakes were too high. It's made out that the stakes are too high." He wouldn't have said straight away, "I'm ready to die for you."
That makes no sense.
That makes no sense. Now, Ratan Singh Pangu says that the Pandits promised that we will become Sikhs if you die for us. But the Hindus
Wow.
refused to, well, this is the Gurtej Singh version. So the Hindus refused to uphold this end of the bargain, proved ungrateful. Only Kirpa Ram became Kirpa Singh and died fighting at Chamkor. However, the Gur Sobha mentions this. Therefore, not explicitly for the Tilak Janu or Taramsala, but for these non-Islamic concepts, Guru Tegh Bahadur decided to shed his life. On the other hand, however, the earliest one we have by Jeta Shri Gur Katha. Now, we discussed this last time as well. So the Shri Gur Katha is actually written by Bhai Jeevan Singh, who was obviously the individual, the Singh who brought Guru Tegh Bahadur's head back from Delhi. And I have the Gur Katha here. I'm trying to find the proper page. That makes a very interesting note regarding, what Guru Gobind Singh actually said. So, what it says really is that this is what Guru Gobind Singh said, upon the time when Guru Tegh Bahadur was actually made a martyr. Now, regarding Guru Tegh Bahadur's martyrdom, this was a very potent event. And what Bhai Jetha says is this, that हल बरो नहीं हिंद का, हाल बुरा नहीं हिंद का, कोई दुख निवारे. Sorry was the state of Hind, sublime the fund of anguish. There was none equipped to purge and deliver us from it all. Then, through the threshold of the Guru, our mourning and lament reached the Lord in Baikunth to spread the fragrance divine upon us, descended at the time the Savior Guru Tegh Bahadur. Now, here is something interesting. Please note this. The crafty and the wicked have twisted the Guru's tenets and tarnished his sacred image. The Guru, however, regards with equal gaze all castes and creeds as one human race. Same as parents who equally love all their progeny, it is a fact God's residence is not constrained to Mecca, Kaaba, or Mandirs. And it seems when we go forward, this is what Guru Gobind Singh has to say about, what has happened. The Guru's follow, the witnesses to the carnage, carnage of Guru Tegh Bahadur, the Hindus are co-sinners and this, they're suffering the grip of shame. So to me, it seems that from Bhai Jetha, what Bhai Jetha is saying, that the Guru decided, because the Sikhs obviously had a dog in this fight all along. And Guru Tegh Bahadur knew that very soon Aurangzeb would be marching to Anandpur to kill him. And that, it would be best to fool Aurangzeb to, leave Anandpur for the meanwhile. He couldn't do it while he was alive, but if he went and died at Delhi, Aurangzeb would be fooled in believing the Sikhs were finished prematurely. And it seems when the pandits arrived at the court, the Guru also criticized them, saying that caste and Sharia are the one and the same. Both deny the freedom of conscience. I'm going out there to die for the freedom of conscience. This is something the Sikhs would usher in the future. If you're with us, that's fine. If not, then we will fight you as well.
So the pundits decided not to go to the Hill Rajput chiefs.
They decided to go nowhere. They decided to come to Guru Tegh Bahadur, knowing Guru Tegh Bahadur was impartial, but Guru Tegh Bahadur was well aware that the pundits weren't impartial, that, caste was the same as Sharia.
No, it is.
And Guru Tegh Bahadur pretty much told the pundits, the fact that most of them left Anandapur and we don't hear much about them again, the fact that only a few stayed behind, Kirpal Ram became a martyr by becoming Kirpal Singh, but Chandu decided to betray Guru Gobind Singh's family. The thing is that they actually thought Guru Tegh Bahadur would lift the sword for them. The Sikhs would die for them. The Guru refused straight away to defend them and said, I'm going to die for the freedom of conscience. Yes, caste is an evil, but it's an evil which can't be destroyed by the evil of Sharia, only through love and logic and rationality. But the Sikhs will dismantle both Sharia, both caste, just because we are confronting Sharia today. Don't think we have forgotten about your system as well. That is what I believe happened.
Well,
That's
it
what I
gives
believe
you
happened.
something to ponder about.
Gives you something to ponder around. I mean, if you look at Dharma, Dharma is based on three concepts. Okay, reincarnation of a past physicality, rejection of social life, and renunciation of social life and rejection of logic. We don't have that type of dharma in Sikhi as well. So it's worlds apart. So even though the event was celebrated as being, for the Hindus, especially when the Bachitra Natak was written, what we read from the Gur Sobha pretty much makes it out to be a universal martyrdom, which was against Islamic practices of, suppressing non-Muslims. But from the Gur Katha, it's evident that the fundamental core value was a Sikh-centric value that individuals have the freedom of conscience, and that is a divine freedom.
Individuals have a freedom of conscience.
So what happens is that the guru journeys to Sirhind with the Pai, Mati Das, Sati Das, and Dyal Das, and down there, they offer their arrest by criticizing the Islamic State. Straight away, they're arrested by the Subedar and dispatched to Delhi. And obviously, we know what happens down there. Aurangzeb is actually in Delhi. This was proven by Sardar Kapoor Singh because it was the rainy season in the Deccan. He wasn't campaigning. He was nowhere else. He was actually in Delhi. That's the thing. So he was in Delhi at the time, personally met the guru. I've seen the cage where they kept the guru in to torture him. Even Khwaja Muhammad Masum could not, convince Guru Tegh Bahadur to convert to Islam. This is what Guru Tegh Bahadur said to Aurangzeb. Look, people call me Sache Padshah. It's their right to call me Sache Padshah. I have weapons. I have horses. I'll keep them. Providence has given them to me. And Aurangzeb told him, why don't you become like Shri Chand and the Udasis? We will have no problem. The guru refused straight away, saying that Shri Chand was, disowned by Baba Nanak. What happens next is that he writes a letter to Aurangzeb as well, that the man you call prophet could not convert the entire world to Islam. So what chance, Aurangzeb, do you stand to convert me to Islam? So look at that spirit down there. He's come there
Okay.
prepared to confront certain death, and he's still got the, I guess, the spirit to confront Aurangzeb on each and every point.
So, okay. Have you seen the movie, The Karate Kid, the modern one?
Yes. Oh, no, not the Cobra Kai one, no.
So it's Jaden Smith, yeah?
Yes.
So there is a scene in that movie that th there is some, let's say, a kung fu practitioner, a female one,
Yep.
and she's trying to copy the movements of a snake.
Yes.
But it's dawned upon him that it's the opposite, actually. The snake is copying her movement.
Ah, yes.
You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. I do.
So in this case, the snake, Aurangzeb, he's not the master of the situation.
No, he's not.
So he is doing what Guru Sahib wants him to do.
Exactly. Now, Guru Sahib, for Guru Sahib, Guru Sahib does not fear death. He's lived an inspirational life. Death is only one of the conclusive parts to that life, not everything. He's done what he has to. He's achieved it. So he does not fear death.
Well, he proved it.
He proved it. Obviously, we know Helpa, Imati Das, Sati Das, Dayal Das are executed, and then subsequently the guru himself, who refuses to convert to Islam and is given their prior, foremost punishment. It's believed in Islam that the infidel without his head will actually hold up his head and confess his infidelity on the day of judgment. So under those rules and regulations, those superstitions, they execute Guru Tegh Bahadur by beheading him. Now, coming to the modern day, now in the present context, a majority of trolls have been making very big attacks against the Guru. We will call them ivory tower intellectual attacks. Now, the first one is that only Sikh sources mention the Guru's martyrdom and no Persian sources mention them. So thanks to Sardar Inderjeet Singh, who actually provided this to us, we have several sources which I'll, mention and just give you a very brief description of them. So these are Gurmukhi and Persian sources, and you would know some of them as well. First one is the Badshah Buranji. Now, Buranji are the historical chronicles written by Assam state officials and nobles. And the scribe may not have personally known Guru Tegh Bahadur or Raja Ram Singh, but wrote what he heard from their official circles. Now, what's happened is that this source does have very problems in it. And what it says is that the Guru had 30,000 Nanak Panthi or, Sikh soldiers. The terms were used interchangeably. And that the fact is that the writer of the Buranji is a Mughal official. So he's actually had to, provide some official, justification for what happened. And he just, says that the Guru was a danger to the state, and the state, obviously, executed him. And something very, funny down here is that the author mentions that Brahman priests and the Kwajis reported to Aurangzeb that the Guru does not belong to any particular school or faith and goes about ravaging the country. So it seems it wasn't only a case of Mughal Islamists being against the Guru, there was more as well. So we have others as well now. So, there is the Raja Ram Singh incident as well. Then we have, obviously the Bachitra Natak. Now, of course, there are problems with the Bachitra Natak, but the Bachitra Natak also mentions that, Guru Tegh Bahadur sacrificed himself for another faith, even though, I guess, pseudo scholars like, what do you call him, Conrad Elstein or something on Twitter, they're trying to actually make it out to be that, it says that he sacrificed himself for his own faith based on the Suraj Prakash, which says that the Guru said, I'm a Hindu and I want to die a Hindu. False story. Obviously, Patwahis are actually a bit more, bit more accurate. Not the Pandavahis, but the Patwahis. Obviously, they say that, but they sort of confuse the narration as well, because some of these Wahis were written after Guru Tegh Bahadur died. So what it mentions is it sort of confuses two events, but we understand that there was the time when Alam Khan Rohilla arrested Guru Tegh Bahadur and that he was subsequently released, and then what led to his martyrdom and his martyrdom. Now there's another book, Kalimat e Twabit, and that actually mentions the Sirhind incident and Mirza Inayatullah Khan's, Akami Alamgiri. That's what his memoirs are called. Then we have Kafi Khan's book, Man Takub Alubab. Obviously, that says the same as well, that, the Guru was a rebel, but it does not mention, him being a ravager or anything. Then obviously we have Patwahi Taluda Pargana Jind, and, Pai Sarup Singh's Guru Kiya Sakhi also corroborates that. So pretty much the same. Bansavali Nama Patwahiya, Brahmin records, they mentioned that, Guru Tegh Bahadur died for the freedom of conscience, even though they give it that pro-Hindu twist. Now, the other one we have is that the Siyar al-Mutakirin. Now, funny thing down here is that according to these trolls, Syed Ghulam Hussain, now the writer of this particular Persian record is Syed Ghulam Hussain. In 1782, he wrote this for the British. Now, funny thing is, according to these trolls, Muslim historians were uneducated, but when they actually have to, utilize them to, disparage someone against them, they will leave no stone unturned in proving their hypocrisy. Now, Sardar Kapoor Singh actually tracked down Hussein's original work in Persian. Now, this was written for the British, as I mentioned, and it has a lot of mythology in it. Hussein mentions about the Sikhs and says that, Guru Tegh Bahadur actually joined Adam Hafiz, who was acolyte of Ahmad Shah Sirhindi, and they ravaged the countryside together. Aurangzeb executed both of them, and Guru Tegh Bahadur was hung and quartered, and his remains were hung up on the four gates of Lahore.
Of Lahore, not
Of
Delhi.
Lahore, not Delhi. Now, obviously, all contemporary Persian sources dismiss this. Our idiot trolls, though, will use this because it is something they believe is against the Sikhs. Fact is that Adam Hafiz had died, maybe, or if I understand correctly, he had actually died 34 years prior to Guru Tegh Bahadur being executed. And there is no question of the Guru joining the house of Sirhindi. So, what we have, what emerges essentially, is that the British deliberately mistranslated the work into English. That's what Sardar Kapoor Singh fought, found. He actually compared the translation by, I believe, the military historian Raymond Briggs, who actually translated it during Ranjit Singh's time. And he found that the Persian never disparaged the Guru. It was only the English version which tried casting the Guru as, being someone who subsisted on rapine and plunder.
Projecting their own habits onto the others.
Yes, and that's why it's very crucial we actually track down these sources. Then we have the Khulasat ut Tawarikh in 1695 by Sujan Rai Pandari. Obviously mentions the same thing, that the Guru was very defiant to the state and executed. Another Persian account is Bhimsen's Nushka-e-Dilkusha. Again, same story, that Guru Tegh Bahadur, had a very large following and Aurangzeb was jealous. Ibratnama in 1719. Same story, that Guru Tegh Bahadur was someone who was actually opposed to Aurangzeb, and Aurangzeb was very jealous of him. Char Gulshan by Rai Chaturman Saxena, 1759 to 60. Same story. And then we have Father Xavier Vendel's, Les Memoires de Vendel sur les Fêtes, les Pathans et les Sikhs, written in French in 1768. And that also makes it out to be a similar incident as well. So we have Persian sources as well, which confirm our side of the story. It's just a matter of us looking into them and not relying on these opportunist trolls.
I'm just trying to contemplate that what could be the entire motivation behind all these activities.
It seems that the first motivation was to utilize the Sikhs as cannon fodder, and then now to discard the Sikhs.
So we are just a branch, not a separate tree.
Not a separate tree. And I guess it's high time as well that we look at our history through Gurbani. We try tracking down our history properly. Now, how many people, I mean, I guess the committee at the Gurdwara I mentioned about the Ganga Sarovar, they're probably millionaires by now.
Well, more than that, mate.
More than that. And this is the story of Guru Tegh Bahadur. This is the history of Guru Tegh Bahadur. And we need to start, if we focus on the fact that the Sikhs were some nationalist or territorial force, our achievements are pretty much zero. If we focus on the truth that we were there to change the world from the start, then our achievements become quite significant. That's something we need to remember. Sikh history needs to be relooked at, particularly the history of our gurus.
Oh, we cannot emphasize this sentence enough. We need to track down the original sources. We need to have a look at our history again, and we need to authenticate it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we have such legendary historians, Dr. Mahinder Singh Josh, Bhai Karam Singh historian, Captain Bhag Singh, even Professor Sahib Singh, for what he was worth. We have proper historians. We just need to look at those works.
For me, it's quite easy to believe whatever the local Baba tells me, and then I just say Wagru Wagru 1,000 times a day.
That's not cutting it now. That's not cutting it.
You're telling me that's not enough? That's not the key?
That's not the key. I'm saying it loud and clear. That's not the key.
Well, now, yeah, well, for vast majority of people, that's it. You go to the Gurdwara, you follow your local Santa Baba, and you read Gurbani once in a year or something, and that's it.
That's it. Now, coming back to how this martyrdom culminated, Guru Tegh Bahadur laid down his life for his ideals, but he didn't do it in a fit of passion. He did it with a very cool head. And that's what makes that martyrdom so significant. That's why our legs tremble, because obviously there are people who fortify themselves in buildings and, get ready to fight. But here, Guru Tegh Bahadur is preparing to hand himself over to the enemy, suffer all forms of indignity and humiliation, just so his ideals persist and survive. And ultimately, that's his big victory. Because, something I've seen down there at, when I went to Delhi a long time ago, the Gurdwara where he was beheaded, Sis Ganj. There's a mosque right next to it.
There's
And it's said that Aurangzeb had told the guru that this is the future of India. And the guru had asked him that, why India? Why not the world? And Aurangzeb had said, yep, this is the future of the world. There will be mosques on every street. And the guru had said, well, who knows? Maybe one day people will come here to, remember my Sikhs who you have killed, and there might be no one at the mosque. That's proven right, hasn't it? Because the people at that mosque come to the Gurdwara for langar.
Well, that is true, but I'm being sarcastic here. What Aurangzeb predicted is also coming true.
This is something which the world needs to confront, and the gurus have actually laid down, very golden standards for us. The fact is that we expect others to emulate them. Do we follow them ourselves? That's the foremost question.
And that question needs to be answered in some other podcast then.
Yep, that question needs to be answered in another episode. Thank you very much for listening. Waheguru Ji Ka
Jika Khalsa.
Khalsa.